An old and puzzling question in the study of human psychology has been, what is genius? And by extension, how do geniuses come into being? Are they born, made, or a combination of both? Can you be an undiscovered genius? Well, we hope to answer some of those questions on this week's Please Explain. And our guest is Dean Keith Simonton, a professor of psychology at the University of California, Davis, and the author of The Origins of Genius, Darwinian Perspectives on Creativity, and also Genius 101. And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Write us on our show page at WNYC.org. And you can also join in on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Dr. Simonton, my dictionary offers a wide range of definitions of the word genius that includes intellect, talent, and IQ, among others. Would a psychologist have a different definition than someone in the arts or sciences?
No, I mean, basically, the definitions are very similar, except that, of course, we try to come up with actual measures. And there's at least three major definitions that you see in the literature. One was the one that you implied having to do with intelligence. That's a relatively recent one because you had to have IQ tests to have that. The American Heritage Dictionary provides this arbitrary cutoff of 104 year above, and then you're a genius. So that's one definition.
And then Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
By the way, that's kind of arbitrary. It's basically the top 1% of the population in IQ. You know, they could have picked something lower, like Mensa. You only have to be in the top 2%. And then there's others like the Four Sigma, where you're in a stratospheric range. But anyway, that's one definition. And then the other definition, which is much older, is some kind of outstanding and unique achievement that leaves a permanent impression on a domain and perhaps even a culture. You know, you have someone like Michelangelo or Ludwig van Beethoven, and they not only had an impact on specific domains of creativity, you know, art, music, but they're part of our culture. Albert Einstein, man of the year, or man of the century for Time magazine, is another example. And the third example, and I don't particularly like this, but you still see it, is someone who is a child prodigy. They'll often be referred to as geniuses or maybe young geniuses because they're doing things at, you know, some ridiculously young age that normally you have to be an adult to do. So those are the three main definitions that you see in the research, and you also see them in popular culture. You see them show up in dictionaries. The one I prefer is the middle one, the exceptional achievement, having an impact on your field. That's really unique. I'm not talking about you could have impact without doing something really special, unique, or something requiring intelligence, like being an assassin of a world leader, for example. You have impact, but it doesn't require any exceptional intelligence.
But haven't some exceptional people scored poorly on IQ tests? I'm not talking about assassins. I'm talking about people who've done something wonderful.
There's many examples of that. For example, it was kind of interesting study that was done in the early part of the 20th century where they gave IQ tests to a bunch of kids, and they pulled out a sample of over 1,500 boys and girls, and they followed them all the way to adulthood. In fact, they're actually still studying today. Some of them are now deceased, but it's just tremendously ambitious longitudinal study. There was no Nobel laureates in this group, even though the average IQ was around 151. But there was two people who weren't smart enough to make it into the sample. They had, the cutoff was 140. And those two people went on to get Nobel Prizes in physics. So there are many examples. Albert Einstein never took an IQ test, but if he did, I don't think he would have scored at the nominally genius level of 140. So there's not a good relationship. And in fact, the person who was in the Guinness Book of Records, they don't have this category anymore, but the person who was in the Guinness Book of Records for having the highest measured IQ, Marilyn Vos Savant, she's only known, really, for having the world's highest IQ.
I know, and she actually wound up a guest on our show once many years ago. She was doing, I think at that time, doing newspaper articles in which she answered people's questions, but
right.
A lot of people could have answered those questions.
Yeah. But one of the questions that she answered was, why is black clothing more warm than light-colored clothing when you walk outdoors? Well, guess what? That's something that, it's basic physics. She has a tremendous wealth of knowledge. She's obviously very intelligent. She got perfect scores on certain IQ tests. It's just unheard of. She also, on a couple occasions, has answered questions that have stumped the experts. There was this famous Monty Hall problem that she came up with a solution to, and even some very, very distinguished mathematicians disagree with her. But later on, she was vindicated. But it's still, there's still not an example of a single important, lasting contribution that she's made to any particular field, except, I guess, journalism, writing this column, Ask Marilyn.
Well,
so
I also...
go ahead.
I was wondering whether, by these criteria, whether people who win at Jeopardy are the real geniuses, or are the people who get the MacArthur Genius Grants real geniuses?
Well, it's interesting. Even though the MacArthur Foundation doesn't like the fact that their awards are referred to as genius grants, you know, they don't use that term. They do have more justification, because they are looking for people who are having an important impact. They're looking for promise. They try to get young people who are up and coming, who look like they're going to leave a mark, and they want to identify them early and give them some encouragement, because it's a pretty handsome award monetarily, as well as the prestige. And so... you can claim. Now, of course, the thing is, this is a very important thing about this definition, this my preferred definition of achievement. You don't know exactly how the story is going to turn out until the end, right? It could be that it's not going to pan out, that this particular line of research or this particular style of painting or art or whatever is not going to have an impression. It's going to be seen as superficial, or it's the answer to the wrong problem, or whatever it happens to be. And so you don't really know until the story is over. In fact, sometimes, of course, you don't even know until posthumously. You know, Emily Dickinson is recognized as one of the great poets in American literature, but she wasn't recognized as such in her own time, except for maybe her immediate family and a few friends saw that she was more than just a casual Sunday poet.
Go ahead.
Sorry. So I'm just saying that you often have to wait until to the end of the story before you really know whether it's going to pan out. And sometimes it will take, like the case of Gregor Mendel, who discovered the laws of genetics. It took 35 years before the impact of his discoveries were fully appreciated.
My guest is Dean Keith Simonton, professor of psychology at the University of California, Davis. His books, The Origins of Genius, Darwinian Perspectives on Creativity, and Genius 101. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Have philosophers of the past tackled the matter of genius? Did Aristotle ever write about genius?
Aristotle had a few comments about it. One of the things about the ancients is they had a doctrine of the muses. And so special creativity, you know, there was a muse for every major art. There was a muse for dance. There was a muse for poetry. There was a muse for history. So every major art form had a muse. And so, you know, you got the inspiration from them. So there was a kind of a quasi-religious or animistic view of genius. The word genius itself didn't come into being until the Romans. It's actually a Latin word. Men were born with a genius, and women were born with a Juno. And the genius was roughly like our guardian angel concept. It was someone who stuck around wherever, whatever you did, looked out after you, like in the movie It's a Wonderful Life, and basically defined what was unique about you. And so everybody had a genius. But over time, the idea became more exclusive, and particularly during the time of the Renaissance, where only certain people had a genius, you know, something really special that enabled them to produce something unique. So one example of that that it emerged in philosophy was Immanuel Kant in the 18th century defined genius as someone who could produce something that no one else could do, that there were no rules or guidelines for producing what they do, that they make their own rules up. And, in fact, it's kind of interesting. Immanuel Kant said you can only have genius in the arts. You can't have genius in the sciences because the sciences have mathematics and they have logic and they have method. You get trained in how to do it. He specifically singled out Isaac Newton as an illustration of someone who's a scientist who's not a genius.
Oh, well, I think Newton was a genius. There are mathematical geniuses. Einstein, we now call a genius, and was all of his work was based on math. So I guess Kant, who was pretty smart, had certain biases.
Yeah, he had biases. He saw fine arts as being the core of genius.
But there are differences between mathematical genius and artistic genius, aren't there? There are people who are brilliant mathematicians or artists or whatever, and are totally incapable of handling the most basic social interactions. And you have to wonder whether they are really geniuses or whether they are just focused in have one kind of intelligence that has one kind of focus.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because at one extreme, you have those people we call savants. And these are people who are phenomenally precocious, well, prodigious, and yet extremely poorly developed in basic social skills and even being able to take care of themselves. And at that extreme, usually they can't really realize their talents because they're just so disabled in the other areas of just everyday living. But then there are cases in between that extreme and normal people. For example, there's good evidence that a lot of great mathematicians and theoretical physicists, Albert Einstein is an example, and Isaac Newton is an example, that are clearly on the autistic end of the spectrum. They lack some basic social skills. They are often very inept. They are often very introverted and isolated. Newton would always turn on his friends. He was paranoid. He had this weird idea that they were going to try to get him married to somebody because he hated women. You know, Einstein was notorious for, in the middle of a conversation, just get up and leave, you know, because he got an idea. So you do have that tendency for the mathematicians to be more towards that, you know, the autism end, more interested in things than in people. And then on the other hand, you have the artists are more likely to be at the other end, highly emotive, highly involved, maybe too involved, you know, lots of different relationships and risk-taking and all these other kinds of things. And so they end up being more close to the bipolar end of the spectrum.
Well, in both cases, you're talking about people who have some form of mental illness, and there is that popular notion that the most brilliant people are vulnerable in that way, the crazy genius. But have links been found between the two?
It's interesting. It's a very old idea. In fact, Aristotle talks about it. He says that anybody who's a major achiever in art, philosophy, or even politics must have some tendency towards, the term he uses, melancholia, because they, you know, they had the four humors theory back then, and that would be the black bile that makes us depressed. So, and since he was a great philosopher and listed philosophy among those areas of achievement, perhaps by inference, you could say that he was confessing he had tendencies towards melancholia. So it's a very, very old idea. It's also very controversial. There are people who take very extreme positions. There was an Italian social scientist in the 19th century who said you had to be insane. And that was a very common idea. You had, all great achievers, all great geniuses had to be insane. And then there's another movement, like amongst the humanistic psychologists and the positive psychologists, who say quite the contrary, that the greatest achievers are the ones who are the most mentally healthy, more mentally healthy than the average person on the street. Okay, so how can you reconcile these very diverse opinions? Well, you can, and in fact, I've published a lot of work on this recently because it's an area that I think got polarized, unfortunately, and people have taken extreme positions and have argued that everybody's right, that creators as a whole are probably more mentally healthy than the average person on the street. That is the risk rate for various disorders on average. But extreme creators, people at the very extreme end of the distribution, that's that big, long tail out there of the normal curve, they can have higher propensities towards various kinds of mental illness. But still, because there's so few of them, when you average across all creators, they still end up having a lower baseline risk than the average person on the street. So that basically argues that they can both be right. And I've collected data, and I've also done some mathematical analyses showing that this is true, that there is a tendency in some areas, particularly the arts. You suggested this earlier. In the arts, there is some tendency, particularly in writing and the visual arts, for there to be a positive relationship between pathological symptoms and creativity or eminence achievement in the field.
Well, do we see that in Shakespeare or Leonardo da Vinci?
That's an interesting question. We don't know enough.
They're pretty brilliant.
They're very, very brilliant. We don't know enough about either one to know, really, one way or another. And of course, there's always exceptions, right? But we certainly see it in a lot of other figures. We see it, I mentioned Emily Dickinson. She was obviously had serious mental health problems. She got to a point in her life where she couldn't even interact with people. There was one occasion where she had some visitors, and she just allowed them to see her walk by the door in a hallway. That's the form of communication that she permitted. And, of course, a lot of it is just relatively innocent psychopathologies, if you can call them that, like alcoholism, drug abuse. Those are kind of things that are symptoms of pathological disorder. Anxiety and depression are things that are often associated with particularly creativity in literature, that don't necessarily have to show up in the way of putting someone in a mental institution. They're just incapacitated for a while. They can't write. Hemingway was a good example. And, of course, that eventually led to suicide. The suicide rates are much higher amongst creative writers. So, there's an increased propensity, but it doesn't – this is the important thing. There's two points. First of all, there are plenty of examples of totally healthy people who are great creators. And, Goethe is a good example. Perhaps Leonardo da Vinci, who you mentioned, is a good example.
Bach.
Maybe even Shakespeare, you know? Bach. Yeah, Bach's a good example. But not Beethoven.
Mm.
Okay? He had serious psychological problems. And so there are plenty of examples. And at the same time, we have to admit, it is extremely rare. In fact, you could say it's almost impossible, although I can think of a few exceptions, for someone to have a debilitating degree of psychopathology for their entire life and end up being a major contributor to any given field. Perhaps one exception that a lot of people would be familiar with is John Nash, who, you know, has been dealing with schizophrenia for basically his entire life. And a lot of people have seen the film Beautiful Mind. He's supposedly okay now, but what I've read is he still sees or hears things. He just has learned how to dismiss them. So that's a serious psychological issue. But he's managed to have times when it hasn't prevented him from coming up with ideas. You know, he was once asked, you know, how could you believe this stuff? You know, you see these images, you hear this stuff, and then how could you even believe this is real? And he says, because it comes from the same source that I get my ideas for, you know, in mathematics and economics. So it's hard to distinguish between the two.
We have to take a little break here.
Yeah, sure.
My guest is Dean Keith Simonton, professor of psychology at the University of California, Davis, and the author of a couple of books on genius, The Origins of Genius, Darwinian Perspectives on Creativity, and Genius 101. And we invite your calls to 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with Dean Keith Simonton, professor of psychology at the University of California, Davis, talking about genius on today's Please Explain. Is there, in your view, such a thing as an evil genius? Can we call Hitler, Stalin, or Mao evil geniuses?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on your definition. And some people would like to put a qualifier. So if you're going to define genius as someone who has an exceptional impact on history and on a domain, and you're going to leave off whether it is good or bad, you're not going to pass a value judgment on it, then clearly Adolf Hitler has to be considered a genius. Stalin has to be considered a genius. And so, of course, there's still people who believe they were, in fact, positive contributors to civilization, but the majority don't. So, yeah, you can have evil geniuses. I don't like that term, particularly since there's one thing that's a problem about some evil geniuses. Like Adolf Hitler is a good example. He didn't actually achieve what he set out to achieve, except for the Holocaust, which obviously had a permanent, you know, very lasting contribution to human civilization in a very negative way. He did not make Germany greater. He did not create this huge Reich that was going to rule the world, at least large parts of it. And so you can say he was a failure. His main goals were not achieved. So if you're going to say that a genius is going to achieve, has to achieve the goals they set out to achieve, then maybe you can't consider him a genius. But then if you do that, then how do you handle Albert Einstein, who just spent most of his latter part of his career, wasted it, in fact, trying to create a unified field theory and never succeeded? And in fact, now there's a universal consensus amongst theoretical physicists that his attempts were doomed to failure because he did not accept quantum theory, didn't try to integrate quantum theory into his unified field theory. So it's a really tricky thing. You know, when you start talking about, you know, another example, a more recent example, is Osama bin Laden. The 9/11 attack was clearly one of the greatest acts of terrorism in the history of the human race. And he achieved what he wanted to achieve. So are we, of course, he didn't like the end of the story, but nonetheless, do we consider him a genius?
Well, on the other side, if the odds are entirely against you because of the age you were born in, or you were born as a slave, you're a woman in many societies and throughout history as an impoverished person, or you're the member of a hunter-gatherer tribe in the Amazon, it's almost impossible to tell whether you could have done anything to change the world.
Yeah, I mean, this is the interesting thing, because We have every reason to believe that the potential of for genius is universal. It's universal across gender. It's universal across ethnicities. You know, it's a universal property. But most of the time, there are situations that prevent people from realizing that genius. And sometimes it will just come out of the blue. I mean, a really interesting example that I like to use is Islamic civilization, where for a long, long time, the Arabs were kind of in an intellectual backwater. They had some really great poetry in classical Arabic, but otherwise they were kind of an intellectual backwater. And then all of a sudden, they were converted to this new faith, the Muslim faith, and they started a series of conquests spreading that faith, took over some old civilizations in Persia and Egypt, and assimilated the knowledge of these old civilizations. And within about a century, we're making world-class contributions, contributions that were premier in the world, like in mathematics, for example, and in medicine, and in great art as well, just out of the blue. So where did that come from? You know, another interesting example is the Jews of Europe. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to mention the Enlightenment, which is another case where suddenly so many people are doing brilliant things. And then all of these things seem to be momentary flashes, and then we return to something less likely to produce a lot of geniuses.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. In fact, this is what I actually did my doctoral dissertation on way back in 1974, is the issue of why genius clusters. You have these golden ages where all of a sudden you have lots of geniuses appear at a particular time and place. They'll last for a couple generations or so. There's some variation in that. And then the torch is sort of carried someplace else. And so, you know, the classic example is Athens, where all of a sudden, out of the blue, you have this incredible golden age in almost every major area of creativity and also leadership, both military and political. And then Athens becomes a backwater of the Mediterranean civilization area, and for the most part still is. And so why is that? And there's a lot of factors, and it's not all psychological. This is where we need some economists to chime in and some political scientists.
It would be zeitgeist, wouldn't it?
Yeah, zeitgeist. And zeitgeist in the broadest possible sense. We're talking about economics. We're talking about politics. I mean, in the case of Athens, for example, a huge part of it was the fact that Athens, as a result of these wars with the Persians, set up the Delian League, and dues were paid, and Athens argued that they can use part of these dues to rebuild the Acropolis that had been destroyed during the wars. And all of a sudden, there's this huge pump of money. It was like they had the National Endowment for the Arts set up. And so they could fund these incredible art projects and have schools and attract people, intellects, to set up academies, you know, like Plato's Academy and Aristotle's Academy. So if you pump wealth, and the similar thing happened in Italy during the Renaissance, mm-hmm. where the Medici family, the great bankers of Europe, the wealthiest people at the time, got an interest in the arts. They could have gotten interested in war, but they got an interest in the arts and started becoming patrons of the arts, and some of them became popes and were associated with the papacy and made that a center of art. And so sometimes it's just, you know, it's money, politics. Often when a nation breaks free from a large empire, it has a big burst of creativity because all of a sudden it's okay to write in Polish again. It's not outlawed language. So there's a lot of different factors that operate, and that's probably why it's so rare, because all this stuff has to come together all at once. There's this big, huge flame. It's brilliant. Everybody has to put their sunglasses on. And next thing you know, it's just dying embers.
Well, they're all spurring each other on for a little while, inspiring each other.
Right.
And then it dies out, as you say. I want to sneak in a call here. Richard from Sussex County, New Jersey. Hi. You have to make it quick.
Hi. How are you? It's an interesting conversation. I think we're indulging in too many generalities, though, such as psychological problems and even genius itself.
Well, there are a lot of people who do believe that you got to be neurotic to do something brilliant, although some pretty great people went through psychoanalysis and still did brilliant things.
Right, but I also think that there are a lot of people who feel isolated in the world and therefore what we might call either sad or depressed, but maybe they feel isolated because of their genius. I think it's very rare to find people who are like you when you fall into that category at the far end of the spectrum. And loneliness is probably one of the greatest contributors to mental problems. I know with Dr. Nash and his schizophrenia is far different from somebody who is miserable all the time and whom we might call depressed, but you may have very valid reasons for being sad, which is not depression.
But one of the problems is depressed people tend not to do anything. They are just overwhelmed by their depression. Geniuses are people who achieve.
Right. And a lot of times they find that their creativity, their creative achievements, is a way of getting around these symptoms, that as long as they're creative, then they can keep depression at bay. But then when they stop being creative and look like they're running dry, then the demons start coming back. But the thing about isolation is important, too. I mean, it's no wonder that a lot of high IQ organizations have come up so that people who score, you know, superbly high on an IQ test can have someone to rub shoulders with and have a conversation with. Because otherwise, they're going to seem awfully nerdy to the average person on the street.
I guess that's why they created Mensa.
Yeah, Mensa. You know, even though it's a more liberal definition, 2%, it's still, you know, you have to be pretty bright to get into Mensa.
Although I would assume, based on some of the people I've met through Mensa, I'm not a member, that you don't have to be a genius to be a member of Mensa.
No, you don't. In fact, I used to be a member. It was when I was single and I was hoping to find a very bright mate.
Well, and we can't get – that's a whole other please explain, and we have to end it here. Thank you so much for talking with us, Dr. Professor Dean Keith Simonton of the University of California, Davis. We've been talking about genius, later some other time about dating. Thank you so much for being on our show.